Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Israeli prosecutors say Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his deputy prime minister could soon be indicted on bribery charges. What would that mean for the government?
You've got the number one official and the number two official both under this cloud. The number three official in the governing Likud party can't be prime minister because he's not an elected member of the Knesset. So basically, it's a real mess.
And a reporter's unique access on the hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq with Chief U.S. Inspector David Kaye.
I think he must be disappointed. I think he felt he would find the weapons of mass destruction on the ground when he got there.
These stories and the Singing Sisters Kneeled coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The military says two U.S. soldiers are dead and one is in critical condition after their camp in Bakuba, Iraq, was struck by mortar fire yesterday. In a separate incident yesterday, at least three women traveling in a minibus going home from work at a U.S. military base died when the vehicle was ambushed by gunmen. Iraq's most influential Shiite leader may drop a demand for early direct elections to a governing assembly if the U.N. and Iraq experts agree that they're not feasible. A spokesman for Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani says the Ayatollah wants to hear about alternative ways of choosing a new assembly. The U.S. has wanted a system of caucuses, but until now the Ayatollah has resisted that, holding up plans to transfer power to Iraqis by July 1st. Democratic presidential hopeful Howard Dean is calling for changes in the political money system. After finishing third in the Iowa caucuses on Monday, the former Vermont governor hopes to bolster his outsider image in tonight's debate in Manchester, the last before the New Hampshire primary. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Dean says big money corrupts politics, and all federal candidates should raise money the way he does, depending on small donors instead of those relatively few Americans who write $2,000 checks. So he would reduce the maximum allowable contribution to just $250. He would offer middle-class donors a 100% tax credit for their donations. Dean would also overhaul the public financing for presidential primary candidates. He rejected public funds in November, saying the accompanying spending limits are obsolete and unworkable. Senator John Kerry, Dean's leading rival, also opted out. Kerry has lately been saying he will stand up to special interests in Washington. Dean's reform package builds on one he announced when he opted out of the public financing. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
A coalition of activists and college students is challenging California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's rollback of car registration fees. The tax cut was a key campaign pledge but has deepened the state's budget crisis. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
Last year, then-Governor Gray Davis tripled the car registration tax, restoring it to late 1990s levels under a state law that let him do so without legislative approval during a financial crisis. The fee hike was unpopular, and rolling it back was a key campaign pledge of current Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. It saves car and truck owners about $4 billion a year, money that's supposed to go to local governments. Either they'll do without, or the state will likely go deeper in debt. The University of California Student Association and two other groups have filed a petition with the state Supreme Court asking the court to immediately overturn Schwarzenegger's action. They say he did not have the authority to cut car registration fees when the state doesn't have enough cash to replace the lost revenue. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial Average is down 1.5 points at 10,622 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down 14.5 at 2128. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Eastman Kodak Company announced major job cuts today. The photography company said it will eliminate 12,000 to 15,000 positions worldwide, or about 20% of its workforce, and take charges of up to $1.7 billion over the next 3 years as it makes the transition from the film market to more emphasis on digital products. Kodak also announced an 83% decline in fourth quarter net income. It says it expects the job cuts will save $800 million to $1 billion by 2007. Kodak had already dropped some 22,000 jobs in the last 5 years. Its workforce in 2003 was about 64,000 people compared to 86,000 in 1998. It appears the New Jersey Nets will be heading to New York. Although the sale still needs formal approval, the owner of the team says it has agreed to terms with a Brooklyn real estate developer to sell the Nets. From member station WBGO in Newark, Doug Doyle reports.
Yankee Nets board members are set to vote tomorrow on a deal that would sell the Nets and move the team to Brooklyn. Developer Bruce Ratner bid what's believed to be around $300 million, edging out a group that wanted to keep the team in New Jersey. One of the members of that group is U.S. Senator John Corzine. Ratner's purchase brought Brooklyn closer to being home of a professional sports team for the first time since the Dodgers left for Los Angeles after the 1957 season. Ratner hopes to move the team into a new 19,000-seat stadium that would be part of a $2.5 billion residential and commercial complex in downtown Brooklyn. Opponents say the stadium would displace more than 800 people. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
The Conference Board's Index of Leading Indicators posted a ninth consecutive gain in December. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The indictment yesterday of an Israeli real estate tycoon could have political implications for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Prosecutors say that David Apple paid Ariel Sharon, Sharon's son Gilad, and Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert huge sums of money in exchange for their help with major real estate deals in the 1990s. Though formal charges have not been filed against Prime Minister Sharon, the opposition Labor Party is already calling for his resignation, and charges could be coming soon. Keith Richburg has been covering the scandal for The Washington Post. He joins us from Jerusalem. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you quote a labor official in today's paper as saying, there's the Sopranos on television. This is the Sopranos of Israel. Tell us, the indictment concerns several transactions. One is reportedly in which David Apple, the developer, was accused of hiring Sharon's son, Gilad, at an inflated salary, hoping to curry favor from his father, who was then foreign minister.
Exactly. You know, it really is incredibly complicated, all of these various transactions, but the specific one involves a Greek island resort that was proposed by this David Apple.
Well, so far, Apple and Sharon both deny vehemently that there were any bribes, but the indictment reportedly says Sharon threw a big party for an official who could help with Apple's real estate project, and that he, Apple, deposited hundreds of thousands of dollars into Sharon's family interests.
Prosecutors are definitely saying, yes, this money was transferred. They can prove it. They wouldn't have brought these charges if they didn't think so. Apple's lawyer has denied it. Ariel Sharon has not been saying anything lately, but what he has said in the past about these allegations is that if the money was transferred, he didn't know anything about the family finances. He was too busy being involved in politics, and he doesn't really know anything about all this.
And what is the public saying?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the public now, there's a brand new poll just out today after these indictments in an Israeli newspaper that says 53% do believe he was involved in some kind of shady dealings. Mm-hmm. And another 63% believe he should step down when it's proven or if it's proven.
Well, again, there hasn't been an indictment yet against Sharon, but if he is indicted or even if he isn't, what happens?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people, including some of Sharon's sort of supporters, you know, conservative columnists or others, are saying he's damaged goods right now, even if he is not indicted. And mind you, prosecutors are saying he still could be. Prosecutors are openly telling journalists that the prime minister could be indicted in a few weeks. Even if he's not, if David Apple goes to trial, he will be convicted, if he is convicted, for giving bribes to Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, and Gilad Sharon.
Let's mention Ehud Olmert for just a moment. He's deputy prime minister. He's charged also with taking bribes from Apple when he was mayor of Jerusalem. What happens if both Olmert and Sharon leave office?
It's a mess. I mean, it's a mess because Likud is still the strongest party in the Knesset, the parliament, but you've got the number one official and the number two official both under this cloud, this possible indictment hanging over them, or even if there is no indictment, this allegation that they accepted bribes, The number three official in the governing Likud party is Shaul Mofaz, who's the defense minister, but he can't be prime minister because he's not an elected member of the Knesset. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's a real mess, and they'd have to have some kind of an internal party struggle that may see the former prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, coming back to power.
Mm-hmm. Keith, briefly, what kind of time frame are we looking at for whatever unfolds to unfold?
A couple things can happen quickly. First of all, the prosecutors are saying it could be the next few weeks, possibly sometime in February or later, that Sharon is indicted. That's coming directly from the prosecutor's office. If there is no indictment, even the trial of David Apple should be starting in the next few weeks or months or so. And there are not elections scheduled here until 2007. So most people do not think Sharon will fill out that full term.
Keith Richburg, thank you.
Thank you.
Keith Richburg writes for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Jerusalem.
Republicans gaining access to confidential files. Got a familiar ring? But no, we're not talking Watergate here. A much more up-to-the-minute controversy is Republican staff members of the Senate Judiciary Committee reading on their computers supposedly confidential Democratic memos on strategy for blocking Bush administration judicial nominees. It's being called the Pickle investigation because Senate Sergeant-at-Arms William Pickle launched it. Joining us on the line is Charlie Savage, Washington reporter for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you.
The Pickle investigation, Republicans getting a hold of Democratic strategy memos via computer. What exactly happened here?
Well, what we now know is that when Jim Jeffords defected from the Republican Party in 2001 and Patrick Leahy took over the Judiciary Committee, which is the committee that screens all the appointments to federal judgeships, a new computer technician came in who created a mistake on a shared server that both Republicans and Democrats on the staff of this committee used. Republicans at some point discovered that they were able to read or access the accounts of Democrats, which Democrats thought were password protected. And now we know that for more than a year, Republicans were able to monitor what Democrats were saying in private meetings, both from memos accounting what had been said in those meetings and talking points prepared to go into those meetings. And that sometimes it appears they were leaking some of these to sympathetic media.
And all having to do with the sorest point, perhaps, between Republicans and Democrats in Congress, the question of judicial appointees. One appointee, the Hispanic American Miguel Estrada, who President Bush very badly wanted on the bench, eventually gave up. And there's a lot in these memos about Democratic strategy to block that nomination, isn't there?
That's true. This allowed Republicans to see which nominees Democrats were planning to block, when they thought that they might allow certain hearings to be scheduled and which hearings they would not allow to be scheduled. And in a more general sense, it allowed them to see the inside of the Democratic thinking.
Charlie, is what they did illegal?
Well, that remains to be seen. One of the issues upon which the legality of this will turn is whether or not these memos are considered to be official Senate work product. If they are considered to be official Senate work product, people who are exceeding their authorized access to obtain them could be in a great deal of trouble.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? The Republicans, some Republicans anyway, are actually blaming the Democrats, saying they should have closed this computer glitch. What do you make of that? Is that true?
Well, Republicans are saying that one of their computer technicians told a Democratic staff technician of this problem in the middle of 2002 and that Democrats just didn't do anything about it.
But is the suggestion by the Republicans then that this stuff just popped up on their computer screens and they couldn't help but read it? The devil made me do it?
Well, the suggestion is that you could sit down at your computer and just click on a window and there it was. And there was no password protecting it, and you were looking at it on your own computer screen.
So what is the ultimate significance of this, do you think?
Well, a couple things. First of all, it marks a major escalation in what has already been more than a decade now of quite bitter partisan warfare over judicial nominations. The committee staffers for these two sides are really like the Hatfields and McCoys. Utterly intense loathing for each other. On the other hand, one of the things that I think is most interesting about this is that both sides have something to gain and something to lose from greater attention to this infiltration. For the Democrats, this scandal is all about Republican dirty tricks. The Republicans continues to highlight also the content of the memos, which in their mind shows an improper amount of influence by outside liberal interest groups in choosing whom to filibuster.
Charlie Savage is a staff writer for the Boston Globe in Washington, D.C. Charlie, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
This week in his State of the Union address, President Bush called judges who have moved to allow civil unions and same-sex marriage activists who are enforcing their arbitrary will upon the people. And Bush called on the nation to defend the sanctity of marriage. Well, yesterday the Ohio Senate seemed to respond to the president's call, voting to ban not only gay marriages, but domestic partnership benefits for state employees, whether gay or unmarried and heterosexual. And in Georgia, a group of Republican senators is moving to strengthen its already existing legislative ban on gay marriage by passing a constitutional amendment. Well, joining us on the line now is Paul Martinek. He's editor of Boston-based Lawyers Weekly USA. And Paul, to Georgia first, why add the constitutional amendment if there's already a law banning same-sex marriage?
What legislators in Georgia are trying to do is they're trying to make the state ban as bulletproof as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. Having a state law is one thing, but if you have it written into a constitution, that prevents the judge in Georgia from saying that the state law violates the state constitution.
Perhaps with an eye to Massachusetts and the Supreme Court here that ruled that same-sex marriages are allowable under the state's constitution.
Well, that's exactly right. What they're worried about in Georgia is that gay marriage will become law in Massachusetts and a couple will move to Georgia and demand recognition there. Mm. And they'll claim that the state law is unconstitutional. And if that battle comes up in the Georgia courts, then a judge will be able to look to a constitutional amendment in Georgia and say, well, at least it doesn't violate the Georgia Constitution. Mm.
Well, we read that Nebraska, Alaska, and Nevada already have amendments to their constitutions barring same-sex marriage. But more states, 37, simply have legislation barring same-sex marriage. And that brings us to Ohio. As we said, the Senate there has passed legislation. It's going to go to the House and then to the governor, where it's expected to be signed into law. But Ohio has also added benefits. How unusual is that?
What Ohio has done is really twofold. Ohio's law is, in one sense, a traditional Defense of Marriage Act, as these statutes are called, which attempts to prevent Ohio from having to recognize a same-sex marriage from another state. But Ohio goes a step further in essentially saying that Ohio will not recognize any domestic partnership benefits for same-sex couples. So they take it a step beyond the mere non-recognition of same-sex marriages to try to prevent any kind of marriage-like benefits from being provided to same-sex couples.
And back to Georgia. Georgia's constitutional amendment is being proposed by a prominent Republican, but it has to pass the House there, which is predominantly Democrat, although far more conservative Democrat in the South. I want to ask you, Paul, what is the legality of, let's say, a legal marriage from Canada or one perhaps soon from Massachusetts in a state that has a constitutional amendment or a ban on same-sex marriages?
The problem for opponents of same-sex marriage is, and what they're so concerned about, is that under the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution, generally one state's marriages are recognized in another state. And while they may attempt through statute or amendment to the state constitution to get around that, there's going to be a constitutional battle in every state over whether or not those statutes and those state constitutional amendments violate the federal constitution. And there's a pretty strong argument that states, regardless of what they do, are going to be forced to recognize Massachusetts marriages between same-sex couples.
Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Paul Martinek, editor of Lawyers Weekly USA. He spoke to us from Boston.
Just ahead, a BBC reporter wins extraordinary access in Iraq to follow the odyssey of U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kaye from believer in Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction to coming up empty-handed.
And later, taking the voter's pulse at a New Hampshire health clinic.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Vice President Dick Cheney believes weapons of mass destruction may still be found in Iraq. He said so on National Public Radio yesterday. But the Bush administration's chief weapons hunter in Iraq, David Kaye, is expected to resign next month as head of the 1,400-strong Iraq survey group that was charged with and has so far failed to find WMDs. Well, on PBS stations tonight on Frontline, BBC reporter Jane Corbin presents a report on David Kaye and his frustrating search. Corbin won extraordinary access to Kaye. She joins us on the phone from Amman, Jordan. Jane, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bill.
And thank you, Jane. Jane, who's David Kaye?
David Kaye is the man who essentially is in charge of the hunt for Saddam Hussein's weapons. He was himself an ex-United Nations weapons inspector who famously discovered the documents in a car park more than a decade ago that led the UN to Saddam Hussein's nuclear program. He's somewhat of a true believer. Before the war, he was saying he believed that they still had WMD, and after the war, he was the man sent to find them. Now, he's been there, and he's been hard at work for many months now. And what was interesting for me as I filmed his progress and charted the ISG's work was to see what was a certainty in those early weeks to turn it into doubt.
Now, Jane, of course, as you pointed out, he's a man who saw what Saddam Hussein was able to accumulate of weapons of mass destruction after the first Gulf War. So it's not completely surprising, is it, that he believed that the man probably still had them or badly wanted to get them?
Yes, and you know, I've known David Kaye for many years and made a number of films with him, and he always used to say that Saddam Hussein's regime was into cheat and retreat, which is they lied, they didn't tell the truth. And I think that's the mindset that he went with.
Let's listen to a moment in your documentary, though, when Kaye discusses one find that seemed important. Trailers, many of our listeners may remember them, that the U.S. government said were mobile germ labs. Let's listen.
I wish that news hadn't come out.
It was premature to announce them as being that definitely and embarrassing.
I think it was premature and embarrassing. That's why I'm so reticent in my discussion with you when we're talking now, because I don't want this. I don't want the mobile biological production facilities fiasco to be the model of the future.
This documentary, Jane, becomes very much the journey of a man's consciousness about the presence of weapons of mass destruction. Here he is in Midsummer saying that what he believed had been there wasn't, and that it was actually embarrassing.
David Kaye has been in a difficult position because he's caught between his own conviction and obviously the desire of the politicians to back up those statements they made and the necessity to do a good and thorough job and to overturn every stone in Iraq and find out what the truth was. And it's been very hard for him. To his credit, he has carried out a very forensic mission. They've had 1,400 people on the ground. They've literally been everywhere. They've spoken to hundreds of people, and the end result so far has been no action. Weapons.
They've spoken to hundreds of people, one blind alley after another. Now, one person they've been able to speak to is Dr. Amer al-Sadi, who ran Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. Dr. Amer al-Sadi always said there were no weapons. Tell us who he is and what his situation is at this point.
Well, Dr. Amer al-Sadi, certainly David Kaye believes, has been very central to the whole WMD program from the start. And he is a man who was involved in both the missile program and, it's believed by the UN, in the chemical weapons program. But he always maintained, and indeed he said to me before the war, that the weapons they had were destroyed back in 1991. He's very much stuck to that script over the years. And he was arrested, or indeed he gave himself voluntarily after the war. And we visited his wife, who believes implicitly in his innocence, and told us that he has always said that he thinks that history will bear him out. Now, David Kaye and indeed the ISG have had this man in prison for many months, and as far as I've been able to find out, they haven't actually discovered anything new. He is still saying that they destroyed them in 1991.
Then, Jane, in December, David Kaye issues a preliminary report concluding Saddam Hussein had an intent to obtain weapons of mass destruction, but that no weapons of mass destruction had been found. Then a month later, in January, David Kaye tells the Bush administration he wants to resign, even before a final report will be issued.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that David Kaye is frustrated that the hunt for weapons of mass destruction is no longer the administration's first priority. And I think we almost have to see, if indeed he does go shortly, that when he leaves, it is almost the end of the story, the end of the road for the Iraq Survey Group. They may well announce another appointment to replace him. But I think we've all noticed the politicians talking less and less about this issue of WMD and President's State of the Union address the other night, barely a mention of it. And indeed, the president himself has recently given interviews which seem to suggest that it doesn't matter anymore. And I think we're going to quietly see the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction pushed into the background.
I should add that the person expected to replace David Kaye is someone named Charles Delfer, an experienced former UN weapons inspector. But listen to what he said to NBC News on January 9th. Mr. Delfer said, "I think it's pretty clear right now that they're not going to find existing weapons in Iraq of either a biological or chemical nature."
Yes, and that seems to be the bottom line. They are backing off this. They are trying to let down the public gently on this whole question of WMD and to lower expectations at this point.
Jane, knowing David Kaye as you do, what is his mood? What are his emotions, do you think, as he steps down?
I think he must be disappointed. I think he felt he would find the weapons of mass destruction on the ground when he got there. Confusion and puzzlement, too, I think, for him and for other weapons inspectors, indeed for all of us who have been covering this story, as I have, for more than a decade. And I suppose that David Kaye, as he finishes his stint there, must be thinking, what was going on in the mind of Saddam Hussein? You know, will we ever find out, was it a giant bluff, or was it, what was it? And I think there will be a certain frustration that we don't have the answer to that question yet.
Jane, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
BBC reporter Jane Corbin, she joined us on the line from Amman, Jordan. Her documentary on David Kaye and the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq premieres on Frontline on PBS stations tonight.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak to candidate Wesley Clark about trying to appeal to New Hampshire voters whose affections seem to be with the two candidates from neighboring states.
And we review the film The Butterfly Effect, starring heartthrob Ashton Kutcher. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, taking the temperature of healthcare and the uninsured in New Hampshire.
We're rebuilding Iraq. We're trying to rebuild half the nations in the world. And I'm not trying to be an isolationist or anything, you know, but first comes first. I mean, if you can't take care of yourself first, how can you take care of others?
And the Singing Sisters Neils out with a new CD.
John Lennon died the year I was 13, and I was really devastated. And I just
really plunged into guitar playing and started writing songs for the first time.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. With only days to go before the New Hampshire primary, the Democrats still in the race hold their final pre-vote debate tonight. Iowa winner John Kerry is trying to capitalize on his surge. One poll shows him 10 points ahead of Howard Dean. Dean says he's not paying attention to the polls. The strong second-place Democrat from Iowa, John Edwards, says his southern roots should vault him to the top in the presidential race. Problems at the polls could happen again during this year's presidential campaign. That's according to a new report. The report, released today by the Washington-based Election Information Project, says despite promised reforms, only a few states have made comprehensive changes to voting machines. Doug Chapman, director of Election Reform Information Project.
While in many states voters will see changes from what they experienced in 2000, and many other states voters will not. And as a result, in many places, the expectation of reform might actually outstrip reality.
Chapin says federal money authorized for election reforms has been slow in coming. There were dueling demonstrations in the nation's capital today, marking the 31st anniversary of the Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court decision on abortion. Nearly two dozen bishops in the Roman Catholic Church and a few cardinals celebrated mass with thousands of young people before joining other anti-abortion activists for a rally and march that will conclude with a prayer service. Supporters of abortion rights also held a demonstration before lobbying lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Two American soldiers are dead, another critically wounded after a barrage of mortar fire struck an American military encampment in central Iraq. Also, four Iraqi women were killed when gunmen ambushed their vans. The women worked in the laundry at a U.S. military base. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett says the vans were attacked west of Iraq's capital.
This morning, three civilian vans were ambushed on the route approximately 1 kilometer west of Fallujah. The vans are contracted to provide laundry service for coalition soldiers at Forward Operating Base Ridgeway.
Meanwhile, a Shiite leader signaled more flexibility on his demand for holding early elections. Eastman Kodak plans to cut up to 15,000 jobs worldwide, or 23% of its workforce, over the next 3 years. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In his State of the Union address on Tuesday, President Bush said that a government-run health care system is the wrong prescription, as the television cameras cut to the disapproving visage of Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. Well, today, Kennedy is proposing a massive expansion of federal spending on health care, saying his $100 billion plan would create medical coverage for all Americans. Under Kennedy's proposal, firms with 50 or more workers would be required to offer insurance. The federal government would subsidize some of that expense. Smaller companies could either offer coverage to their workers or contribute to a national plan similar to the one offered to members of Congress.
Well, Robin, the issue of health care, of course, concerns many voters this campaign season. And with New Hampshire set to go to the polls on Tuesday, all of the Democratic contenders have announced their plans for reform. Here and Now producer Alan Cockle and I visited a clinic recently in the town of Franklin, New Hampshire, to hear the thoughts of both providers and patients about the state of health care.
Health First, how may I direct your call?
My name is Rick Silverberg, and I'm the executive director of Health First Family Care Center in Franklin, New Hampshire.
Rick, who exactly comes here to Health First for their health care?
A little bit of everybody. We have 5,000 patients currently. About one-third of them have no insurance but are working very hard, mostly in service industry jobs where they have an hourly pay but no fringe benefits. Another third of our clients have Medicaid or Medicare. And then the last third have some type of insurance.
How many are uninsured in the state of New Hampshire?
It's between 13% and 14%. And from what we've seen here, that number seems to be going up. That although things in the economy seem to be getting a little better, the jobs that people have are service industry jobs where they might be working two or three part-time jobs now to try to make ends meet, where their wage might be $7.50 or $8 an hour, and they have no health insurance of any sort. Whereas the previous job they may have had may have been a full-time job where they got some type of health insurance benefit.
If you're sick, you just come here, get medicine, and talk about healthy food. That's why I like the doctors.
My name is Barbara Lynch, and I'm from Franklin.
How important will the issue of health care be when you walk into a booth to vote for somebody?
It's going to be a big issue.
Your son James, who's 5 and has some health problems, do you worry about being able to provide the care he needs?
Absolutely. It's expensive. I mean, I'm here for a medication that is like $78.
When you see an ad on television for a politician, are you more likely to be interested in that politician because of what they're saying about the big issue that seems to be out there, Iraq, or when they talk about health care?
I think both. I mean, I think they're both really important. I think that's why, I personally feel that President Bush is most likely to get reelected. That's such a strong issue in everyone's mind that it's a good reason why he's probably going to stay in office. You know, hopefully he'll do the things that needs to be done to take care of all the other issues, which is medical and schools.
Hi, Danny. I'm going to check your blood pressure.
Okay.
Do me a favor and relax your arm.
My name is Danielle Caradonna. I'm an 8th grade art teacher at McLaughlin Middle School in Manchester.
Danielle, do you have health insurance?
Yes. Fortunately, we have a very strong union in Manchester, and they really fight for our teachers to have excellent benefits.
Danielle, all the Democratic candidates for president running in the primary want to repeal President Bush's tax cuts to pay for better health care, they say. What do you think about losing a tax cut for better health care?
I think that's an important enough issue that I'd be willing to pay for.
Okay, you have an appointment scheduled with Naomi at 1 o'clock. Do you need a card?
Yes, please.
All right.
My name is Kevin Gilmatt. I've been self-employed for the last 23 years. But I think there is something that has to be done with this insurance for the middle class and the self-employed, and because we just can't afford it. I'm talking thousands of dollars a year, which is more or less what I would make in a year just for insurance.
What do you make of the fact that in this country that's so rich and powerful, there are people like you who work hard, but if something happens to them, they don't have any health insurance and they don't have any way to pay for care and medicines without going through all kinds of complicated procedures and getting all sorts of complicated help. Why isn't there health insurance for everybody in this country? And what do you think of the fact that there isn't?
Well, I think of the fact that there isn't, I think it's really sad because we put so much money, like right now, we're rebuilding Iraq. We're trying to rebuild half the nations in the world. And I think, and I'm not trying to be an isolationist or anything, but first comes first. I mean, if you can't take care of yourself first, how can you take care of others? And so I really have a problem with taking care of the rest of the world and not dealing with ourselves.
Okay, stand up on the scale. Do you remember what you weighed last time?
No.
You weighed? Looks like 162. I'm Elaine Bussey, and I'm the clinical coordinator here at Health First.
How well is the healthcare system working in this country?
I think it's well for those that can afford it. For those that can't afford it, it's not working very well at all.
As you comb through the Democrats' plans around health care, which you've done, what's missing?
The funding. You know, where are they really going to get this money from? You know, some of them have very grand ideas and some of them, you know, not so big. But there's still that question of they're not really been clear on where they're going to get the money from and where it's going to come from.
My name is Peggy Haney, and I live in Tilton, New Hampshire.
Peggy, how important will health care be as an issue for you when you go in and make a decision about who to vote for in the primary in New Hampshire this year?
That won't be the only thing that I'll look for, but I think that would be right up there in the, you know, the top two or three issues that I'd look at. We've just had a change in our insurance, so we've had to look around to different physicians, and it's had a big impact on us financially and in our health care. And for a while, we had to change from a physician that we had seen for over 20 years to a physician that was totally new for us.
Have you made a decision about who you're going to vote for?
Not definitely, no.
What would you like to see happen that's not happening?
That's a good question. I don't know that I actually have an answer for that.
Peggy Haney of Tilton, New Hampshire, and a patient of Health First Family Care in Franklin, New Hampshire. Our visit to Health First was produced by Here and Now producer Alan Cockle. A reminder, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the latest from New Hampshire. We'll be speaking to candidate Wesley Clark about how he's hoping to bring himself up in the polls.
And if you'd like to see just how the Democrats for candidates for president stand on health care and other issues, go to our website, here-now.org, and click on the Vote by Issue quiz.
Still to come, Katrina and Narissa Neild out with a new CD.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
After our mention of President Bush's recess appointment to the federal bench of U.S. District Judge Charles Pickering, John Zimmerman of Hopkinton, New Hampshire, correctly pointed out, I said people say Pickering is a segregationist, when I should have said opponents say this about him. Zimmerman went on to say, as for the truth of his racial views, while Democrats usually get a pass on questions of racism, Republicans have to be very careful about whom they support and what they say. Let's look forward to the day when Republicans and Democrats alike are judged not by their party affiliation, but by the content of their character.
Several of you wrote, after our editorial roundtable discussion on Judith Steinberg Dean, the working doctor wife, of course, of presidential candidate Howard Dean. Patricia Long of Reading, Pennsylvania, for one, took issue with my comment that Hillary Clinton at one point had a hairdo a week under the constant media glare. Patricia writes, this is both untrue and misogynistic. Why would any woman have to consult her family, let alone the nation, in order to maintain an up-to-date appearance, as Hillary Rodham Clinton has done?
Well, Steve Lynn of Brattleboro, Vermont, appreciated our story illustrating how the U.S. swamped a cooking oil company in Ethiopia by dumping U.S. surplus in the form of aid on the Ethiopian market. He felt we didn't go far enough in our conversation with Andrew Natsios, the head of USAID, who said there are now checks and balances against that happening.
It makes it sound like the problem is fixed when actually that's far from the case. These checks that are meant to protect local production and commercial importation in third world countries are actually left to the organizations that benefit from the dumping of food aid.
Mm. So the same people who are supposed to do the analysis to see if the food aid is needed would pocket some cash if, in fact, the food aid was delivered.
Right. They're the ones that sell the commodities and get the money in order to run their programs. Yeah.
What would you like to see happen as far as food aid?
If the U.S. Wants to invest in the development of a lot of countries, which is a great idea, it should send the aid in the form of money for programs and not as agricultural surplus from the U.S.
Hmm. So be a player in international development as opposed to handouts.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Our coverage last week of the Iowa caucuses brought this impassioned response from Guy Center of Morehead City, North Carolina. Horse racing, horse racing, horse racing. Just stop it. Stop it now and don't start again. I'm sick of it. You're reinforcing the vote for the winner tendency that's made politics in the U.S. such a joke of late.
Okay, we're rounding the bend here, Bill. Finally, Mary Jones of Philadelphia writes, I just want to compliment you on whoever picks your music. Any number of times I turn it on and hear Radiohead, Nirvana, Fugazi, all used as music bridging between different segments. It's nice to hear snippets of these records on a national program. Well, thank you, Mary, and here's a little more from Fugazi, Arpeggiator off the CD End Hits.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to include your full name and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Neilds, the rock, folk, and a little bit country band featuring sisters Katrina and Arissa Neilds, has broken through on indie radio with songs such as Easy People.
Easy People.
Best Black Dress.
In my best black dress.
The sisters are known for their perfectly blended voices and quirky writing, covering on 11 releases now, everything from Black Dresses, Georgia O'Keeffe, Albert Einstein's Out of Wedlock Daughter, to Love and Kisses and Snowmen. Their latest CD as a duo is a concept album, and it plumbs the depths of ninth grade.
I said nothing works today. Everything is broken. Everything is choking on ambivalence. You put a plastic angel on my desk and said I cannot fix this, but this may help to move you toward deliverance. Glow in the dark, plastic angel, it's the first day of spring. Nothing's making sense anymore.
Glow in the dark, plastic angel from Narissa and Katrina's new album. It's called This Town Is Wrong. It comes with a soon-to-released book for young adults, and it tells the story of two 13-year-old girls who take up songwriting to get through adolescence. And Narissa and Katrina Neilds join us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Such a pleasure to see you, as it always is. And I'm wondering, as soon as I heard that you were writing, Narissa, I thought, 13-year-old girls. You were a 13-year-old girl once. Isn't that when you started singing?
That's exactly when I started singing.
Yeah.
That's right. It was John Lennon died the year I was 13, and I was really devastated, and I just really plunged into guitar playing and started writing songs for the first time, or successfully wrote songs. I'd always tried to write songs, but when I was 13, I actually began finishing songs.
And what did you want to say in this CD about 13-year-olds? And tell us about the two that you write primarily about.
Well, they're characters from the song This Town Is Wrong, which is an earlier song of mine. And the narrator, Randy Rankin, is a sort of independent only child of her father is a performing singer-songwriter named Guy Rankin, and her mother is an acupuncturist. And Randy lives across the street from Angela Riddle, better known as Jelly Riddle, who is a child model whose mother is pushing her very, very hard to have a successful career as a child model, or a teenage model, as it's now becoming. And Randy sees that there's a lot more to Jelly than just her pretty face and her ability to appear perfect. And Randy wants to start a rock band, and she wants Jelly in her band because Jelly's pretty and has a great voice. So the book is about Randy encouraging Jelly, and then it's, as you know, stories do turn. Jelly ends up kind of saving Randy too.
Katrina, I know that you saw something at a show once that inspired one of the songs.
Yeah, well, Narissa and I were playing a show with Dar Williams, and I had my daughter with me, and she was small enough at the time that she couldn't really sit backstage and be quiet. So I was out in the lobby, and I happened to see a father and his teenage daughter, and I thought it was just lovely that they were at a concert together. And I thought they're probably at that point in their relationship where they're communicating almost entirely monosyllabically. Mm. And yet they found this cross-section of their lives to meet at. And I don't know whether the dad dragged the daughter to the concert or if the daughter dragged the dad to the concert or if this was still the one thing that they could share. Mm. It was a lovely thing, and I asked Narissa to write a song about that relationship, and it just happened to coincide really well with her book. So,
right. The song we're going to hear in part, we're going to start in the interior of the song. It's called The Day I Let Glory Steer, and it's in the voice of the fictional father, Guy Rankin,
right,
talking about his daughter.
Call her up on the cell phone. More and more she is not home. She's out with her friends and she wouldn't talk to me if she could. She sees me as an old man now. She's fighting all her own bands now. And the sign on the door to her room says closed for good.
Narissa and Katrina Neils performing for us The Day I Let Glory Steer from their new CD, This Town Is Wrong. Were you always friends? Did you always know, you're nodding yes, Narissa, that you would be, you were always this close?
Well, we were always incredibly close, but we didn't have like the easiest night. I was not very nice to Katrina. She was always nice to me, but I was sort of mean to her. And especially when I was 13, I was mean to her. But I do remember that when I wrote my first song, when I finished my first song, the first thing I thought was, this would sound nice with harmonies. I'm going to make Katrina, my little slave, sing a harmony on this song.
And at the time, really, when Narissa was, when Narissa was 13 and I was 11, we were more than 2 years apart. We were about as far apart in age as we were at any other time. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was when you were 13 and I was 11 that we were both given solos in the Christmas play at school. And it was the first time I realized that you sang.
And it was the first time I realized that you sang.
Yeah, it was a huge revelation. So I was ready and willing to be her slave.
I want to listen to another song. It's called When I Let You Into My Closet, and it speaks to that fear of not only finding yourself, but then revealing what you found to someone else.
When I let you into my closet, right behind the leopard skin coat, will you still revere and adore me? Will you just become more remote? Tell
to go for the Neils fans who are wondering. This is obviously a duo sister album. Is there going to be another Neils album?
I think that this is probably the recording process. On this record, even though it's called Nerissa and Katrina Neils, there are 4 out of 5 of the original Neils. My husband, Dave Chalfin, who was the bassist for the Neils for all of our time, produced this record and plays all the guitars and all the bass on it. And Dave Hauer, the drummer for the Neils, is playing drums on it. And actually, we're all going to get to play together as a band a number of dates for this, to celebrate the release of this record.
Well, Nerissa and Katrina Neils, thank you so much for coming in to talk about the new CD. It's called This Town Is Wrong. And so is this song. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
This town has so much at stake in you. Do you have any idea what they put you through? They tell you you will go for a little star. How I wonder what you are when I watch you wearing your jewels. They want you to have long hair, short skirts, clear skin, nothing hurts, following their every rule. Why don't you make the rules? Why don't you make the rules?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
We'll see a day in the life of a health clinic in New Hampshire.
And we speak to a filmmaker who followed Arms Inspector David Kaye around in Iraq.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.